Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Political Football, the podcast that digs into the global political stories behind the sport. I'm Jason Cowley, editor of The New Statesman.
And I'm Stephen Bush, special correspondent at The New Statesman. This is a special series devoted to the 2018 World Cup, and over the next few weeks, we're going to be following all the action in Russia and analysing it with our guests.
And I'm delighted to say that today we're joined by David Goldblatt, author of The Ball Is Round, A Global History of Football. Okay, so it's the morning after the big night. England are in the quarterfinals. Stephen, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling pretty elated. I'm feeling like football is coming home. I mean, one of the really surreal things about this tournament, it is essentially the first time in my remembered lifetime that I've unequivocally been able to like the England team. And the second is, it's basically the first time since 2002 that watching the England team has not been, whether in victory or defeat, a painful and slightly ugly experience. And it's kind of continued that with the happy ending of Southgate kind of, you know, being able to get the monkey off his back of the missed penalty, us ending our World Cup hoodoo on penalties. Weirdly, I felt quite relaxed throughout the penalty shootout, other than when Henderson walked up because his body was wrong. It felt like he was going to do a very tame penalty.
So Henderson was taking the third English penalty, at which point Colombia were leading 3-2 in the shootout.
Yeah, and I kind of thought, oh, your walk is wrong. I can feel you're going to do... And then what he did then do, which is a very tame and telegraphed penalty, because in preparation for this, and also because I'm just this cool, I looked back at all of the penalty shootout failures, right? And I actually think they fit into two distinct groups. The one in Italia 90 and in 1994, where all of the penalties, sorry, in Italia 90 and in 96, where they all do the right thing, right? Even Pierce's missed penalty, he's trying to take the keeper out of the equation, like Van Persie always used to do when he was our...
So you're saying he's hitting the ball high.
He's hitting the ball high. And Colombia's missed penalty, ditto, he was trying to take Pickford out of the equation. And I think there's less shame in missing a penalty like that. Whereas if you compare that to, say, England going out in Euro 2004, where the penalties are weak to the left, you know, they are penalties taken in fear. And these were, with the exception of Henderson, very confident penalties from...
2004 from were the Euros in Portugal.
In Portugal, yeah.
Stephen, what is it that's likeable about this squad? What is it that makes you feel more comfortable about this group?
I think it's a lot of things. I think one, it's partly the excellent Players Tribune website, which kind of where they're speaking about their lives, and you know, and I mean, I will fully admit that I am a massive sucker for any story where it's like, oh, you know, I grew up without my dad and I want to do right by my mom, and anyone thinks just like, I too, Raheem, know the pain. And so I fully admit that I'm easily gulled by that kind of thing, but they also just seem like a nice bunch of people. They don't have a kind of hint of thuggery or sort of kind of flashiness to them. And also, they just seem to be quite an affable side which works hard for one another. I can't remember, someone tweeted, said one of the things they liked most on football is when the striker puts a thumb up to a winger who's overhit the path. So it's kind of like, I see you, man, you're trying. Don't let your head down. And they just feel like a very nice team. And Southgate is, of course, such an articulate kind of advocate for progressive football.
David, in Bristol, you're down the line today. Are they likeable? What's going on?
Well, first of all, there's no David Beckham and there's no John Terry. And there's simply no getting away for it that John Terry was the icon of all that is thuggish as a kind of convicted racist, certainly by the Football Association. Yeah. And David Beckham, you know, bless him, for all his dead ball skills, bought a kind of air of self-obsession and commercial savvy and, you know, wag and celebrity-related nonsense to the occasion that made the entire circus incredibly unlikable. I think this is a young, humble team that looks like and feels like urban England. You know, I love it that we've got Harry Kane has got Irish roots. Dele Alli's father is Nigerian. Eric Dier grew up in Portugal. But we've also got a bunch of kids from Yorkshire, you know, like a solid Yorkshire Sheffield contingent as well. And I think that makes, you know, all of those things come together to make them visibly and personally so much more likable. And I love what I love about Gareth Southgate is that he will not bend to the false and ludicrous narratives and closed questions of the English football media. He's got his own line and his own take, and he simply will not be swayed by them. And I find that incredibly, incredibly likable.
Yeah, David, you mentioned the diversity of the team.
Yeah.
Southgate himself has said something very interesting about this. He says, we're a team with our diversity and our youth that represent modern England. In England, he continues, we have spent a bit of time being a bit lost as to what our modern identity is. I think as a team, we represent that modern identity and hopefully people can connect with us. That's a very significant statement from an England football manager, isn't it?
It's an amazing statement and full of insight. I mean, I think we have struggled in the past to find an identity as an England team, indeed as an English nation, because we've been so consistently bound to the tropes of Britishness. Mm-hmm. I mean, having lived for 200 years inside the carapace of Britishness when facing the rest of the world, we have completely forgotten all the alternative non-imperial versions of Englishness that are available to us. And that's why the England national football team doing well is such an amazing cultural and politically protean moment. It's an opportunity to imagine an alternative kind of nation, not the English stroke Britishness of the Brexiteers and of Wiltshire. You know, I've been thinking, I know this is crazy, but I've been thinking all morning of E.P. Thompson speaking at the Glastonbury Festival in 1984. And it sent a shiver up my spine to watch it this morning when he said to the crowd, this has not only been a nation of money makers and imperialists, it's been a nation of inventors and writers, of theatres and musicians. And it is the alternative nation that I can see in front of me now. Now, it's not Glastonbury 1984, but I feel a little hint of that. And, you know, so many people on the left run a mile when English nationalism or even patriotism rears its head and want to concede the ground, you know, to the imperialists, to the racists and the banal.
Is it because they're fearful of unleashing forces or demons that have been contained for so long? As you rightly say, since the Act of Union of 1707, there's been a desire for Englishness and Britishness to be interchangeable or coterminous in some way.
Jason, it's been unleashed. What are they waiting for? I mean, what is Brexit if not the return of a kind of peculiarly antediluvian and ignorant version of English nationalism? The cat's out the bag. You know, it's like, what are you going to unleash?
Stephen, what do you think? What are we unleashing? What's going on here?
I think, yeah, the interesting thing, right, is Brexit is ultimately going to be a moment of a profound reduction of British / English influence in the wider world, because we will either be significantly poorer and therefore weaker, or a rule taker and therefore weaker. But in any case, the kind of underpinning of Britain as a dominant global, you know, kind of mid-sized power is going to take something of a hit. And so people will want to, yeah, I think weirdly the continuing power of, say, Boris Johnson is that people will want this sense of themselves being plucky and, yeah, and kind of all of that sort of stuff. The positive thing about the England team is it can be a kind of model of a different type of politics, partly because it does physically represent the groups that, you know, the young, the ethnically diverse, that were defeated in June 2016. Although, of course, the other thing about it, it is a team for everyone, and it does unify people around an idea of Englishness that is not narrowly ethnic, which, yeah, kind of there's lots of interesting polling that lots of people do think of Britishness as a multiracial identity and Englishness as a monoracial.
By which you mean a white ethnic identity. But this team offers the possibilities of a different kind of Englishness, of the kind that David was talking about. Is David being too hopeful? And can you imagine, had Sam Allardyce remained manager, that we would be talking about the England team in the same way as we are today?
I mean, candidly, I think if Sam Allardyce had been manager, we wouldn't have got out of the groups. We would have had a grim 1-1 or 0-0 draw with Tunisia, where we would have failed to break them down.
You couldn't imagine Big Sam talking about diversity, the kind of things that Southgate's been talking about, which has so impressed us, but also Ruth Davidson, the leader of the Scottish Tories, tweeted about Southgate's remark, how impressed she was by his humility, his wisdom. Are we going over the top, in other words? What's going on, David? Are we overreacting here?
On that, it's also his commitment to doing his homework. And yes. Trippier is the same when asked, you know, how come we broke the hoodoo? One word. Practice. And this is a version of Englishness that seems to me is precisely the opposite of the kind of flapping fool, upper class fool version that Boris Johnson represents, yes. Where you can just get away with anything, where, you know, you don't need to practice, where your multiple layers of inherited and unacknowledged privilege somehow means that you can, you know, bend the world to your will without actually putting some work in. And, you know, the state of the Brexit negotiations demonstrate where that goes, and doing your homework and doing your practice, that's what Gareth Southgate
is the whole Johnson shtick, isn't it? Effortless superiority. That's meant to be what he offers us, yeah?
Absolutely. And that's a particular, you know, that version of Englishness is one born of the public school sporting cultures of the late 19th century, where it was seen as bad form to practice or train too hard. And look where that gets us.
So amateurism, the ideals of amateurs. But David, what I like, what we're seeing in Southgate's England is a team with a system and a structure. And you could see even at the end when they were exhausted, they were still holding to the structure of the team. Compare that with the sort of the chaos of Roy Hodgson's England, for example.
Yeah, I mean, just the simplicity of saying, right, this is what we're going to do. Everybody goes with it. Don't fiddle around too much. I mean, particularly, you know, for an international team where you really haven't got a lot of time to get it together. And I think this tournament has proved that, you know, teams that can manage a modicum of personal chemistry as well as on-field discipline will beat out those with the superstars who are not organised.
Has it helped that Southgate's worked for the under-21s? He's been committed to this project that the FA has had to nurture younger players from the under-17s, under-18s, under-19s into the under-21s and then into the senior team?
I think it has. And I think the key word, Jason, is nurture. I really like that about Gareth Southgate, is that he is there's a degree of, you know, personal empathy and commitment to his players, that he's not about barking and giving orders. He's not even about, you know, a sort of techno wizard. It's a multifaceted, as all educational and kind of managerial processes that work are, that, you know, relies on empathetic emotion. Genuinely want to nurture and grow someone, give them space to screw up sometimes as well. You know, I don't know about you, but that's how parenting and nurturing and education generally works. And we have kind of, you know, in something in public life, actually often forgotten that. And I love it that there's someone with that philosophy nurturing these kids.
Stephen, are there any particular players that you're impressed by in the England setup? They're not an exceptional side. They play with good technique. They've done well to make the quarterfinal.
Yeah, so I think Lingard is my favourite player.
Far quiet early. Last night, I thought.
But he still had some wonderful passing moves, and he was unlucky not to create more. I mean, in some ways, Lingard is the is both the fulcrum and the frustration of this England team. And his approach play is wonderful. He's at the centre of all of England's best and most fluent moves. But at the moment, his end product is not what we would ideally wish. Although, of course, he's still very young. I think partly because my favourite, I mean, the best part of football is you know, not kind of the past in the kind of quite arid way that sort of late period Spain have become, but the kind of final, you know, the defence spitting pass, or the pass which allowed Belgium to get that very late goal against Japan, where, yeah, that kind of, as David Winner says, you know, suddenly the pitch is open and wide, a miracle.
Stunning goal, stunning
goal. Yeah, it was. And I think Lingard has to be my favourite for that reason.
My worry, David, is where the goals are coming from if Harry Kane isn't scoring. And also, we've done very well from set pieces. What, three of Harry's goals have been penalties. The fourth goal was a sort of inadvertent flick off his heel. And then a couple of sort of tap-ins from close range. I mean, where are the goals going to come from other than Kane?
Can I say, what a great worry to have, though. Let's just, like, put this in perspective.
Quite.
You know, it's like, here we are in a quarterfinal of the World Cup, you know, facing the winner of Croatia, Russia, if we go through, an extraordinary opportunity. And, you know, we've got Harry Kane, so we could have worse problems. I mean, I think, as John said, you know, the midfield and... God, I'd so love to see Raheem Sterling, you know, score
a goal.
Stick it down Piers Morgan's throat. Yeah. I can't imagine actually a better thing. So I think you're right, though. Jesse Lingard and Dele Alli, who I want to be my favourite player, but who has simply not been, you know, been on it enough to be that. A little spark of creativity there that we saw in the early moments of the Tunisia game. We're going to have to find a little bit more of that. Who's going to be on the end of it? That's another matter. But I think we're going to need to find some energies there to break down a team like Sweden, who are, you know, as disciplined as you like. I mean, it's going to be...
They came through the group system. France were in their groups. They knocked out the Netherlands. Then they took down Italy in the playoffs. I mean, they're a very hard team to break down, very well organised.
To break down,
very
well
organised. Lost to Germany in the final seconds to a kind of miracle free kick by Toni Kroos. So,
and then beat Mexico 3-0. They're a dangerous side, Sweden.
Absolutely. I'm sort of thinking, you know, it's slightly, you know, an under-par Tottenham facing a very kind of G'd up Huddersfield in the Premiership. Going to be very, very difficult to break them down. To be honest, I'm kind of relying on Harry Kane. I think that is where it's going to come from.
And David, I think we should talk about Belgium and how good are the golden generation, but why are the left so uncomfortable with patriotism?
You know, how long have you got?
And why is it, you know, what's going on?
The left in part, I mean, certainly the contemporary left, have themselves been unable to disengage Britishness and Englishness. I mean, of course, the left's greatest moment in this country is 1945 to 1951. And it is the creation not of an English welfare state, but of a British welfare state with all of, you know, the NHS, you know, British steel, British coal, you know, the nationalisation of these industries. That was the core of you know, the left's finest moment. And in so doing, I think we managed, like the right, to forget about the separation and the distinctiveness of Britishness and Englishness. And when we were required, finally, in the 1990s, after the Scots and the Welsh made it very clear that this party couldn't go on forever, that we had to reconsider English nationalism, we had completely ceded the field to the racists and the fringe. And there was a desperate lack of intellectual creativity and historical knowledge within the New Labour project, because it's not like alternative versions of English nationalism and identity hadn't been outlined in the work of people like E.P. Thompson, you know, George Rude, Ralph Samuels. I mean, there's a whole kind of alternative agenda there that we could have explored. And it's one of the great failings of the New Labour project that we didn't go there, and we reap that.
What about Corbynism? Why is Corbyn seemingly so uncomfortable with English patriotism when and I'll come on to Stephen, but first you, David, because Corbyn seems to me to be an international socialist, so the causes that most animate him are foreign affairs, a United Ireland, Palestinian liberation, anti-Americanism, anti-imperialism, and he seems deeply uncomfortable with Englishness, even though in many ways he's a quintessentially English figure with his interest in allotments and marmalade and train timetables and manhole covers. You know, he's an English eccentric of a kind Orwell would have enjoyed and recognised, but he seems deeply uncomfortable.
I agree. I agree. I mean, I think, you know, that would go for quite a lot of that, of certainly the older part of the Corbyn constituency. And I think it's partly because we've just failed to think it through and we haven't had the intellectual and the cultural imagination to do better. I mean, in part, I think because the most traditional parts of the Labour left have failed to engage with popular culture as a real terrain of political conflict. You know, he may like Arsenal, but I never get the sense that the Corbynites really understand that popular culture has become one of the central domains in which, you know, identities, meanings and alternative identities and meanings are going to be made. This is not the stuff of kind of, you know, backroom momentum conversations or even kind of leftist conferences. This is something that's out there and they don't have the language and the instincts, I think, to engage.
Okay, Steve, but Stephen, wasn't Blairism also, or Blair, didn't that coincide with the cult of Cool Britannia, Britpop? Didn't Blair understand popular culture in the way that David is saying?
I don't know. I think one of the reasons why New Labour struggled with Englishness is you had an MP from the north of England, but who had a British identity because he was both Scottish and British. And then you had as his successor a prime minister who was Scottish at a point where, because of the result of the 2005 election, yes, quite a big majority, but a majority in which England was ruled by the Welsh and the Scots, where that became more of a pain point for New Labour. I must say, I actually don't think that Englishness is something that the kind of Corbyn inner circle struggles with, you know, particularly that kind of young kind of media outrider, you know, Matt Zarb-Cousin, Aaron Bastani, and in fact the kind of vocabulary and sort of clannishness, and one of the ways that they kind of build this sense and it's an exciting project before, is very much like talking to ultras in a football team. And of course, exactly as you say, Corbyn is an English archetype in a way that I can't really think of a Labour leader since Wilson, who's quite so, well, I don't think Jeremy does it consciously in the same way, but I was in St Ives last week, obviously, we did some walking, and I reflect on the fact whenever I go on a long walk in England, I pass a nod at someone who sounds and looks like Corbyn. Everyone who's gone to a non-league game has talked to someone like Corbyn. And he kind of, I think one of the interesting things, although his generation of politics is less, well, he is of the generation where British, you know, grew up with Britishness and Englishness as coterminous. But he's able, I think, to oversee a more English-facing discussion because he is so English himself.
There's a radical tradition that Corbyn associates himself with, the Levellers, the Chartists, CND. And you're right, he's the kind of guy who would have been on Ban the Bomb marches, anti-imperialist marches. But what is it about Corbyn and the flag? Is it because he's an anti-imperialist that he's uncomfortable with the ideas of the old British state, as it were?
Well, I think it is primarily a generational thing, right? And we talked about this in a couple of weeks ago, right? Then because up until the 90s, the English team waved the British flag. The English flag, for a lot of people who've, you know, been on marches against the far right, is something only the far right waves. Although, of course, you know, Jeremy has watched both of the games. He is genuinely into it in a way than, you know, not every politician who claims to follow football is.
And Theresa May is a cricket fan, isn't she?
Theresa May is a cricket fan, yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
David, let's talk about the Belgium's golden generation. They're in the quarterfinals against Brazil. One of the theories I've put, at least, it's probably wrong, that the reason Belgium has struggled as a football team is because Belgium itself is a fractured pseudo-state. But this group of players, erratically coached by Martinez, admittedly, seem to have got something together. What do you think?
I mean, I think that the nature of Belgium and of past Belgian teams reflected the subdivision into Walloons and the Flemish. And certainly past teams have struggled with, and the press has struggled with, who's in, who's out, what are the cliques, and so on. However, there is a third dimension to Belgian politics, which is, of course, Brussels, which is a self-governing region within Belgium, separate from both Wallonia and the Flemish-speaking zone. And this is the team, I think, of Brussels. Brussels, one of the most multicultural cities in Europe, where, you know, the African, North African, and other French-speaking migrants have all come. They don't go, you know, they're not in, I don't know, in Ostend. They're in Brussels. You know, Romelu Lukaku grows up in a migrant ghetto in Brussels. So I wonder whether this team actually does reflect a real identity and can collectively draw on a whole bunch of shared experiences and meanings, because in the end, it's from Brussels rather than Belgium as a whole.
Does Vincent Kompany have Congolese heritage?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I understand that Martinez is speaking to the squad in English, rather than in Dutch or French. I don't think Martinez speaks very good French. But they're communicating with one another in English, which is, I think, very interesting, David.
That's, I mean, you know, as so often, so much of EU business, and I suspect even after Britain has left the European Union, will be conducted in English. I mean, hands down, we know English is the global lingua franca, not merely in football, but, you know, in the arts, in politics, in business, in science. So, you know, add to that the centrality of the Premier League in global football and in many of the people in that team, Martinez himself, no wonder.
Stephen, do you like this Belgium team?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with the characterisation that it, weirdly, what they and France have in common is it's a great team with a coach that I would not describe as that great. And it feels like this interesting conflict between can the quality of the players win out against the management structure. Japan were kind of the reverse, not a team blessed with great players, but they had a good system. They played it along the floor and they played well to their strengths. And they did very nearly get to extra time. I think that point about them being a team located around the culture of Brussels is very apposite. Again, to harping on about the Players Tribune, Lukaku in his very good piece about his growing up says, of course I'm Belgian and I'm from this place. That's what makes Belgium cool, right? Which is what makes Brussels cool. The bit around, other than the quite ugly bit where the government sits. But it will be interesting to see how well that team can do when they come up against people who are as good as them technically and are as well managed.
By which you mean Brazil?
Yeah, Brazil or France. Well, so I think France have got the same problem. But yeah, I think against Brazil, you have another team which is technically adept, but is also a better collective. And I think the problem is Martinez, I don't think is a great coach.
And there are, I understand that there are problems inside the squad, some resistance to Martinez in particular. And at one point in that Japanese game in the second half, when the Japanese went 2-0 up and they played with extraordinary intensity and energy, Martinez was standing on the touchline looking utterly bewildered. Although the substitutions were quite smart, he threw in Fellaini, they got a goal back with the header. And then the astonishing end to that match, when the Japanese, to their credit, were trying to win the game, they had a direct free kick, I think from Honda, tipped round for a corner. The corner came in, Courtois caught the ball, and what, in less than a minute, just over a minute, they scored.
Yeah, with essentially the last kick of the game. And that was, I think, weirdly, I think the moment I learned the most about footballers at university when I was covering the university team, because when you see good amateurs, you really appreciate how smart good professionals are, because Lukaku has essentially a second there to decide whether or not to let the ball run on, as he correctly does, or to take it on. He instead, he lets it run on, it splits the defense.
He dummies, he splits it.
And he has, I mean, you know, that is the amount of time it would take me to, you know, kind of, if I threw a packet of rice at you in a supermarket, if you just think about what you were going to do. Most of us wouldn't do it. It was a beautiful final goal, even though Japan's defeat has ended any hope I have of not finishing bottom in the parliamentary press gallery tournament.
We'll perhaps come on to that at the end. David, you wanted to talk about the forthcoming Croatia-Russian game, which throws up all sorts of interesting political tensions.
I mean, I think it's first and foremost, you know, the World Cup's in Russia. Russia's in the quarterfinals. You know, this will have extraordinary cultural and social ripples through the nation that will be fascinating to see. I think the first thing to say is Putin going to show up? You know, he showed up for Saudi Arabia because he knew Russia were going to do okay, but he hasn't shown up subsequently, and I wonder whether he will show his face. The second thing that intrigues me is that there's quite a bit of needle between Croatia and Russia, certainly after the poisoning episode in Salisbury earlier this year. One of the countries most assiduous in expelling Russian diplomats was Croatia. And of course, the Russians are the biggest allies and supporters of the Serbs in their many conflicts at many levels with the Croats. And, you know, Serbs and Russians have been singing together in the streets of Moscow. So I don't quite know how that will play out on the pitch, but I'm interested to see how it plays out around it.
And Boris Johnson, before the tournament, said that Putin was going to use this World Cup as Hitler used the 1936 Olympics for displays of aggressive posturing and nationalistic propaganda. We haven't seen that, have we?
No, we haven't. I mean, as ever, Boris, you know, masquerades as a historian without actually having the faintest idea or, you know, the merest nuance of understanding about either of these occasions. I mean, clearly, 1936 was a sort of systematic attempt with a kind of steel-hard ideology to use the sporting spectacular to, you know, say something about Aryan domination and racist theories and the rest of it. This is about dissimulation. This is about, you know, this is not about the manipulation of consciousness. This is about the fragmentation of consciousness as far as Vladimir Putin is concerned. This is about distraction. It's not about showing off an ideological position. So I think in that sense, having had the most exciting World Cup on the pitch that I can certainly remember, he must be very, very well pleased.
And he's got the country, as I understand, on lockdown. I mean, there's no protests allowed during the duration of the tournament. The hooligans have disappeared, the Russian hooligans.
That's the brilliance of Putin. He has allowed protests, but in non-World Cup cities. So you number of protests allowed, I think 20 actually, over pension reform. I mean, again, the genius of the man. When do you announce that you're going to raise the pensionable age in Russia? Quite considerably, by 8 years for women, I think, and by 3 or 4 for men. You do it on the opening day of the tournament. And then you allow the protests in non-World Cup cities. And even better, you police them with the same soft touch version that you're doing in the World Cup cities. But this will not last.
No, it will not last. it's an autocratic regime. David, I always ask my guests, and I haven't had many, I make it sound as if we've had hundreds, but who's going to win? Is your tip still in the tournament, or have they gone out? David Winner had Spain and they've gone. John Bew had the French and the French are still with us. Stephen, what was your tip?
Can I change mine? Mine was France, but I want to change.
So you had France originally. Who is it now?
I think I'm going to go with the crazy Croatia bet.
Croatia to win the tournament? I think
they've been. You mean to win the whole tournament?
To win the tournament. I think other than against, you know, a very well organized Denmark side, they have been the team of the tournament so far. Excellent in actually very tough group. They look very fluent. They've clearly got mental strength, as shown by Modric coming back to score a penalty in the shootout. I just think they've got quality all over the pitch. And I think that quite limited, yes, well-drilled, but quite limited Russia side is going to struggle unless they can get a friend from, you know, someone to help them.
What about you? What about you, David?
Well, the head is still where it was at the beginning of the tournament with my £20 each way bet on France.
On France.
And if it's flight of fancy time, I mean, Croatia is too sensible a choice. So I'm going to go with the usual level of unreasonable optimism that England often inspire in me, let's say England.
Not Uruguay?
Oh, bless, I love Uruguay, the first country in the world to legalize marijuana, the most successful leftist project in Latin America, where the Frente Amplio are, you know, 15 years into a hegemonic transformation of Uruguayan society. I love them. The sun shines. But, you know, I've got 20 quid on France, man.
But Bilic, the Croatian and commentator, said of Uruguay, they've got two brilliant forwards, Suarez and Cavani. They've got Godin at the back. He said those in between them are okay. It's enough. Is it enough for Uruguay?
I actually think France are going to beat them. I don't think it is. I wanna believe, but yeah, the money's. I'm not laying off my bet on France. Put it that way.
And Stephen, to conclude, how are you doing in the lobby competition?
So pretty badly, in truth. I'm outside the bottom three. I'm clearly not going to win it. I'm now arming and ahhing about whether or not I want to avoid last place or if at this point it's better to
how many
burn
are
out. There are 220 people in it.
So journalists who work at Parliament.
Journalists, a couple of MPs who we're not allowed to name because obviously they want to be embarrassed by their... I mean, one of them might win it. So they, I imagine, will start broadcasting that all over town. But and then some staffers and then a family of people who work in the press gallery. Thankfully, I have no family who are interested in football. Otherwise, I would be even further down the league, I'm sure.
Stephen, welcome back from Cornwall. Good to have you on the programme. David, great pleasure to have you. The ball is round, the global history of football. Hope maybe have you on again at some point. You've been listening to Political Football and I'm Jason Cowley, editor of the New Statesman. Thanks for listening to Political Football. We'll be back next week with another episode.
In the meantime, you can send us your questions and comments for future episodes via Twitter. I'm on at StephenKB and Jason is at JasonCowleyNS.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.